The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
If you have an interest in heart health, your cholesterol and how statins work, you may have seen some mixed messages about it all online of late. Well, my next guest goes so far as to say we're being lied to about the links between cholesterol and heart disease. Dr. Paddy Barrett is preventative cardiologist at the Blackrock Clinic and he's here. Are you annoyed by all of this, what you've seen online?
Yeah, this kind of drives me crazy. okay. I'll be honest. So let's just be clear at the start. When I say we're being lied to, there is a very strong link between the levels of cholesterol in your bloodstream and the rates of heart disease. So that's that is true. The lie is often where actually people are now receiving their information from. Historically, 10 to 20 years ago, you might meet one or two patients who would have fringe views on an occasional basis. Now it's every third or fourth patient that you're actually meeting.
Okay, so explain to us what they think, what they believe.
So the belief is that cholesterol, which is a particle that circulates in your bloodstream that is necessary for developing heart disease, doesn't actually cause heart disease.
That's what they're being told.
Yeah. So they're being told on social media by groups who obviously don't know the evidence enough or should know better and are using it to farm engagement, that cholesterol does not cause heart disease. And secondarily, that the therapies that we use to lower cholesterol actually do not prevent heart attacks.
Mm. I've seen some of these videos. They're very slick, some of them, very well produced.
Yes.
And convincing.
So, correct. Yeah, they are very convincing. And the reason I will tell you that they're very convincing is they're being shared by people who I will not actually name that actually should know better and are in the field of cardiology themselves. So this is not some fringe influencer who is speaking without any medical background. These are often cardiologists who are actually speaking this information. And so this is where, I mean, I think in terms of like, who do you trust and how do you get kind of useful information, where it gets very hard for patients. And the claim that is being made is that if you take a lower risk individual who has high cholesterol and you treat them with a cholesterol lowering medication, it doesn't actually prevent heart attacks, that you would have to treat approximately 100 people to prevent a heart attack with high cholesterol. And the problem with that claim is that that part is true. The thing that you're not being told is that this is looking at information over only a 4-year time horizon. And so if you take a low-risk individual, the risk is so low that you're unlikely to actually impact the risk of a heart attack over a 4-year time frame.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not interested in 4-year time frames.
It's a longer
I'm
timeline.
I'm interested in 40-year time frames. And so therefore, if you extend out that time horizon to the time horizon of interest, which is the rest of your life, you actually only need to treat about 4 people to prevent one heart attack.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the pushback to that will be, well, then that means I'm going to have to be on a medication for the rest of my life. And the answer to that is which risk do you want to dance with? The risk of the heart disease or the risk of the medication? And the risk of the heart disease is very high. The risk of the medication is very small and things we can navigate around. So it is often this miscommunication of statistics and presenting them in such a way to actually back up someone's argument. So you can paint it in one side or another.
Yeah, but the problem that I seem to be hearing from you is that you now have patients coming to you and saying, I think that I shouldn't be on this cholesterol-lowering medication because it's not doing me any good. And in fact, it could be doing me more harm than good. Is that what you're hearing from people?
Correct. Well, so yes, and also that the very basis or hypothesis in terms of that cholesterol is a causal factor in heart disease is not actually true. So number one, they don't they no longer believe the core hypothesis, which is one of the most firmly and evidence proved aspects we have in medicine. But then number two, what they're doing is they're not then using the tools available to us to actually reduce their risk.
Mm-hmm.
And so this then leaves patients at significantly higher risk. And this is fundamentally down to where people are now getting their health information. Historically, this was from recognized health institutions, but we know that over the last several years, the actual confidence in those institutions has largely fallen substantially. But the trust in individual physicians still remains quite high. But people are spending a significant amount of time on social media and getting a lot of their health information there, which comes from a whole variety of variable trust sources.
And the proponents of this theory, what are they selling, or are they just seeking attention? Is it like the manosphere where, you know, the more attention you get, the more it drives your brand?
So that is very much part of it. Because what happens is you end up with this audience capture phenomenon. What people often want to be told is that they have a risk factor that isn't actually consequential. So everyone kind of wants to hear, maybe there was a thing that I had, but actually now I'm telling you that it's not a problem. And so that's actually very satisfying for people. And it's coming from people who should know the answer to this question. So, you know, they of course, will trust them. But it also often comes from that you're going to say, well, what I do is I sell diets, for example, but you don't need to use the medication because that doesn't work anyway. You should use my diet
or my
supplement, for example.
Yes, yeah. So that makes complete sense why you would be pushing this notion. A couple of questions. I have high cholesterol, but I had to stop taking statins because of stomach pains. What would you advise?
So just like any medication, there's always the potential for side effects. And we always have to recognize that. We're not making a decision here that has no risks on one side and risks on the other. The question is which risk do you want to dance with? Now, the thing is that in general, the medications that we use, statins being one of them, but there's a whole range of other medications, have the potential to cause side effects. Those are generally minor to mild side effects and can be quickly reversed if they happen by stopping the medication. And so you can always stop the medication. You can always evaluate for an alternative cause, and then you can always consider an alternative approach to actually treating the problem. Mm-hmm. And so this happens all of the time in clinical practice. And this is what kind of our day-to-day clinical practice involves.
What might an alternative approach look like, though, if you can't take the statins?
So statin therapy are kind of the bedrock of how we actually lower cholesterol-lowering medications. But not to be too technical about it, but there's a whole other list of medications that we use that have comparable LDL-lowering capacities. Ezetimibe, bempedoic acid, PCSK9 inhibitors.
So you are talking medication. You're not talking lifestyle, in other words. You're talking medication.
It's never a function of lifestyle or medications. It's always lifestyle used until such time as we have ran out of road and we need to add in a medication on top. But we also have to be mindful of the efficacy of lifestyle interventions for lowering cholesterol. Using lifestyle interventions like improving diet and increasing exercise is fantastic for lowering blood pressure. It's just not that great for lowering LDL cholesterol. If you look at the big levers that we can pull, reducing saturated fat and increasing soluble fiber, for example, or losing a little bit of weight if it is necessary, can reduce LDL cholesterol by about 15 to 20%. So at a population level, that's fantastic. But for an individual who's looking to maximally reduce their risk, it may not be enough.
Okay. Another one. Can you ask the doc if eggs are still considered bad for the heart?
The answer here is no, with the exception of some rare individuals who do absorb excess amounts of cholesterol. But in general, the cholesterol that you consume in your diet has very little to do with the cholesterol that appears on your blood test in terms of how you consume and absorb cholesterol. But the answer here is that you can often find out. You can consume a higher amount of eggs. You can check your cholesterol pre and post and see if it makes a big, big difference. And if you're not one of those individuals who has a problem, then you don't have to worry.
Who's going to do that, though?
People do it all the time.
Do they?
All the time. But this is exactly what people are doing in terms of your cholesterol's a little bit high. You need to cut out the butter and lose a little bit of weight and
so
kind of increase your
checking
exercise.
Checking it before and afterwards.
Yeah. So people do this all the time. So this is, that may just sound like an extreme version of it, but this is what people are being asked to do all of the time.
Now, I saw this new study out from the UK Biobank telling us to do a couple of things, and it would reduce the likelihood of a heart incident, heart attack or stroke. And the things were exercise for 4.5 minutes a day on top of what you're doing, eat a quarter of a cup of vegetables, you're smiling at me, and sleep for 11 minutes more. What do you think?
So I think we need to put this in context. This is a UK Biobank study that looked at about 50,000 people over 8 years. So the UK Biobank is an incredibly reliable source of information. But I think what this study actually showed was directionally what you said is true. But what it says for people who sleep 8 to 9 hours a night, who do 40 minutes of moderate to vigorous activity per day and eat a healthy diet, that if you get all those things right, you get a 57% reduction in the risk of a major event like a heart attack. Mm-hmm. Over that 8-year time frame. But if you then just draw a line, like a linear line, and then you kind of dial it back and you say, well, what's the minimum amount you would need to do to get a 10% reduction in risk? It comes down to the things that you talked about.
Okay.
10 minutes more sleep, 4.5 minutes more exercise. But it wasn't as if there was a group who kind of said, do you know what we're going to do? We're going to do 10 minutes of exercise and 4.5 minutes of things.
And
what
it got says, the 10%
yeah,
didn't work like
but
that.
But what I think it does illustrate, though, is very small changes in key risk factors can make a meaningful difference. So small changes are actually worthwhile achieving.
How important is sleep?
I put sleep at the top of the stack.
Really?
Absolutely at the top of the stack. The reason being is that, number one, there's really strong evidence to link good sleep, but particularly regular sleep timings, more so than sleep duration, with better heart health. But the other thing is that if you get sleep wrong, the probability of getting the other factors right.
Don't want to exercise, don't want to eat well, I'm going to have an extra cream egg.
Correct.
I feel tired.
You get sleep wrong, you get everything else wrong. And also, you just feel like hell. So this is why I would put sleep actually at the top of the stack.
Mm-hmm. And sleep before a certain time of night as well. I know you're keen on that.
So the answer here is that if you look at the difference between the duration of sleep that someone gets versus the consistency of when they get that sleep, there is a much stronger link in terms of a benefit of having more consistent sleep rather than a total duration.
Okay, so if you go to bed at midnight and get up at 8, that's okay, is it?
Yes. And so if you need to do that 7 days a week, 365 a year in general. So if you can lock in your circadian rhythm to map onto that, in general, that won't be actually particularly harmful. As long as you can get appropriate levels of deep sleep and you're actually doing, it's the consistency part. Most people just won't be able to be as consistent around that.
Because people will have heard that getting to bed 2 hours before midnight consistently is so good for you, that being asleep before midnight. Does that make any difference?
It will make a difference when you map it onto how our modern world works. Our modern world has a rhythm in terms of the world wakes up generally at a certain time and goes to bed at a certain time. And so therefore, you're more likely to be pushed into adopting the rhythm of a modern world. And if you go to bed 2 hours before midnight, you're likely to get 8 hours of sleep and be up at around 6 or 7. And then you're off kind of mapping onto the normal.
But really
day.
What it matters is consistency, getting enough sleep and getting it at the same time.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Even at the weekends when we might feel like a...
7 days a week, 365 a year. When people say, listen, well, what about the weekends and I want to go out? Then you pay the price.
All right, Paddy, thanks so much. Where can we find you on Instagram?
Just put my name into the Google Fire or on Instagram. You'll find me there.
All right, Paddy Barrett, thank you so much. Preventative cardiologist.
The Clare Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.